Y recuerda, también disponible en Valencia y Barcelona. Además, ahora financiate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupobaugan.com.
La palabra que no tiene un equivalente de una sola palabra en inglés es estrenar. En inglés, cuando usamos algo por primera vez, decimos simplemente
to use it for the first time.
Y si estrenamos algo de ropa, complementos o zapatos, decimos
to wear it for the first time.
Por cierto, planchar es
to iron.
Y descambiar es
swap
o
exchange.
Los cursos trimestrales de Vaughan son ideales para gente que necesita resultados a medio plazo y a un precio asequible. Descúbrelos en grupovaughan.com.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening.
Tune in every day.
Vaughan Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan, Vaughan Radio. All right, I am going to talk on this program about nuez moscada, nutmeg. Nutmeg is, well, you can imagine, from the Indian Ocean. And traditionally used in the cuisine around the Indian Ocean, both for food and for medicine. There was a long tradition of medicinal use in Asia. So, like the other spices, nutmeg, cloves, clavos, and, by the way, the thing that goes around cloves. So yes, cloves, clavos, are covered with a kind of a skin. And this skin can be used, dried and used, as a spice. Now in Spanish that's called matis, in English it's called mace. And perhaps one of the differences between Spanish cuisine and the cuisine of, say, Northern Europe is that in Spain, you do use cloves, especially in the south, in Andalusia, but you do not use mace. And mace is a very good spice. It can be used for many, many different things. It's like cloves, but sort of softer, more delicate, more elegant. You can find it, naturally, in a global marketplace. You can find it many places in Spain, Mathis, but as I say, it is not traditional in Spain. Now, all of these spices are very lightweight. And the Indian traders involved in transcontinental maritime commerce, the Indian traders got extremely wealthy. And then, of course, after that, it was the Arabs during the Pax Arabica, during the time when there was an enormous commercial network all the way from the South Pacific to the Iberian Peninsula, right, under Islam, that was able to affect these enormous transcontinental agreements. And as I say, the transactions there were, again, under the Arabs. And one of the things that the Arabs did was to invent stories about how many of their products, you know, spices and precious stones and incense and other things, how it was so very difficult to get these things in the first place, so risky to get these things, how they were guarded by giant monsters and things like that, that was a way, of course, to justify the increase in price, the markup, but also a way to make sure that these people didn't understand, right, the customer didn't actually understand where these things really came from. So if you say, I got this thing in the middle of a desert guarded by snakes, enormous snakes, well, then, of course, nobody wants to go there. And nobody can imagine where this desert is. But in fact, maybe it came from an island in the South Pacific. Again, light nutmeg. The people of Europe had absolutely no idea where it came from. It arrived in the port of Venice. Venice was, you know, with this Mediterranean traffic, Venice was the big place. Venice became the capital of spices. Venetians' food became the food of spice. Later, that honor went to Lisbon in Portugal. And the Portuguese Empire, going around Africa, the Portuguese were the ones who traded directly with Asia. And of course, after that, it was the Dutch. And the great, great spice market of the world was in Amsterdam. But we'll be talking about that later. The fact is that with the fall of Constantinople, with so many things happened to disrupt and destroy international commerce in the Eastern Mediterranean, that the Portuguese felt compelled to go around Africa, you know, like the Phoenicians had done so many years before, to go around Africa. Vasco da Gama went directly to India. And you can imagine how the Arabs felt about that. They say that when Vasco da Gama arrived in India, one of the people there who saw him had originally lived in Granada. You know, one of the people who had been expelled, you know, from the Nazarene kingdom in Granada. And so they were, that person was able to tell Vasco de Gama, some very explicit things in fluent Spanish. In any case, by the year 1511, you can imagine how urgent this is. You can imagine what an important national priority this is. You have a Portuguese force under Afonso de Albuquerque who comes to the Molucca Islands and takes them in the name of Portugal. Now, the people in the Moluccas cooperated with the Portuguese and told them about the existence of the Banda Islands, the ones where nutmeg comes from. And the Portuguese, at this point, they didn't have the number of people they needed. They didn't have the manpower. They didn't have the force to control the islands. On the other hand, they did break the Arab monopoly. And so the people on the Banda Islands suddenly had more than one customer. They were able to negotiate. Over the next century, Portugal tried to build a fort on the island, but of course the local people didn't let them. In the end, the Portuguese stayed in Malacca and bought spices in the markets in Malacca. Obviously, there was enough to satisfy their demand at a price that was considered reasonable for them. Now, it wasn't long before the Dutch arrived. And the Dutch they got to Banda. They demanded spices in exchange for what they had, you know, for example, clothes, winter clothes for Europe. The local people in Banda had absolutely no use for any of the things that the Dutch were willing to trade. Completely unsuitable. And so the Dutch, unable to trade, unable to get their hands on silver or medicine or porcelain or copper or anything that the Portuguese or that the Arabs had to offer. Well, in the year 1609, the Dutch convinced some of the people in Banda, some of the rulers in Banda, to sign a treaty. This treaty gave a monopoly to the Dutch East Indies Company on all the spice trade in the Banda Islands. Now, I don't know how they were able to do this. I don't know if the Bandanese rulers if they understood what they were signing. In any case, it was a very, very bad deal. It meant ruin. So, they built a fortress, Fort Nassau, and the Bandanese hated that idea. They began a war against the Dutch. They killed the local garrison, the commander, and 40 of his officers. And, well, things started to go from bad to worse. Now, by the year 1615, this is only 6 years later, the English had figured out where the Banda Islands were. The England had a tiny little, two tiny little islands, a place called Run and a place called Ai. And the British forces, they confronted the Dutch. The Dutch at that point were reinforced. They were more powerful. The British had to run away. The British counterattacked. There were heavy casualties on both sides. All of this for spices. When the British defenders ran out of ammunition, the Dutch came and killed them all. Now, 10 years later, the East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, working, if I remember, out of Delft. If you ever go to Delft, you can see this. The Dutch East India Company was, their warehouses, right, almacenes, were there. They decided to have all of the Banda Islands under their control. They used, they used the pretext of this eternal treaty, the treaty that had been signed, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And as a pretext, they said that the treaty had been violated. And the Dutch got 40 of the local headmen, the local leaders, the local chiefs, and cut off their heads, beheaded them, decapitated them. And then there was an attempt of genocide against all of the Bandanese, the leaderless Bandanese. It was absolutely brutal. The Dutch killed something like 15,000 people and left only about 1,000. The survivors were reduced to slavery and forced to work in nutmeg areas. Now, they consolidated production. They burned all of the nutmeg trees except those in the plantation, just as they had killed all of the people of Banda except those who were going to work in the plantation. So, complete control. And a complete monopoly. At this point, the Dutch were able to sell the final product, nutmeg, at something like 300 times its cost of production. So, yes, because they needed more people, because slaves do not reproduce very well, other people from other islands, especially Java, were also captured, taken to Banda, and used in those plantations, used as slaves. Now, England and the Netherlands had all sorts of conflicts at this time, right? England was extending its maritime empire. The way to do this was with enclaves in different areas. Well, the English strategy and the Dutch strategy were pretty much identical. So, in other words, they were each other's main competitor. This was not the French idea of colonization. It was not the Spanish idea. It was England and the Netherlands. And so there were several Anglo-Dutch wars. In the Second Anglo-Dutch War, the British, they still had control of a little bit of Nutmeg. And a deal was made. The Dutch got full control of the Banda Islands. The British were able to leave. And in exchange, the British got something that they had wanted. They got New Amsterdam. They got the Hudson River Valley, what was going to be called New York. So yes, New York in exchange for just a little bitty island producing nutmeg in the South Pacific. Yeah, and that was, again, exceptionally lucrative. Remember that many Dutch people stayed in New York, in the Hudson Valley and so forth. And the Hudson Valley, of course, in the War of Independence, that was going to be a key place. They believed that many of these Dutch, these New York Dutch, they were going to be more sympathetic to the British, less sympathetic to the patriots, the ones who wanted independence. Now, the fact is that the Dutch in the Hudson River Valley, they're going to be there as, some kind of romantic vestige. It was going to be the American author, Washington Irving, the same one who wrote The Tales of the Alhambra. He was in Spain on a diplomatic mission. He was part of the American diplomatic corps. And as part of this, he went down to Granada, stayed there, and wrote about the tales of the Alhambra. Well, before this, which, by the way, an example of romanticism, well, he practiced the same kind of romanticism in New York, talking about the Dutch heritage, bringing it back into fashion, And so the Dutch people, instead of being something half forgotten, a vestige of the past, all of a sudden they became picturesque, right? Quaint. And the Dutch, the New York Dutch, almost fashionable again because of the books by Washington Irving. And by the way, as part of this, some of the Dutch traditions became more important. One of those traditions was Saint Nicholas and Santa Claus, as they called him. And this, again, the origin of the Santa Claus we all know, celebrated at Christmas time. This was New York Dutch, brought to us by Washington Irving. So yes, the British got New York in exchange for one of these islands, one of these small islands in the Bandas. Now, during the Napoleonic War, the Netherlands became part of Napoleon's empire and enemy of England. One of his brothers was sent to Spain. One of Napoleon's brothers sent to Spain as king. Another sent to the Netherlands. Now, there was an excellent pretext for the British to invade land held by the Dutch East Indies and to try and insinuate themselves into the spice trade after fighting, combat, the Dutch surrendered Fort Nassau, and then the rest of the Bandas. Now, the Spice Islands were restored to the Dutch in the First Treaty of Paris. But the monopoly was never part of that. Yeah, the monopoly was off the table at this point. It was out of the question. The British took nutmeg from the Bandas and planted them everywhere. So yeah, Singapore and Ceylon, Sri Lanka today, and Sumatra and Malaysia and Zanzibar and Granada in the Caribbean. All of these places under British control now producing nutmeg. And so yeah, it was much too late. With the nutmeg monopoly broken, the price goes down. Now, when we pay such cheap prices for this spice, for any spice, we don't think that back in the day, all of the stuff we use without thinking was worth its weight in gold. All right, I have to take a short break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Aprender inglés tú debes. Un regalo a hacerte voy. Toma, con el curso online de Vaughan, yo te obsequio.
Apúntate y empieza a aprender inglés donde quieras y cuando quieras. Por menos de un euro al día, entra en aprendeinglestv.com o llámanos al 91-133-5842 y que el inglés te acompañe.
Llamamos a los gusanos en inglés. A.
Lice.
B.
Cockroaches.
O C.
Worms.
La respuesta en dos minutos.
¿No quieres aprender inglés? ¿No quieres conocer expresiones y vocabulario? Ah, entonces no nos busques, porque con nuestros trimestrales mejorarás tu agilidad oral y nivel auditivo y reforzarás la gramática en grupos reducidos y mediante el método Vaughan. Aprenderás inglés. Así que no nos llames al 91-133-5833, 91-133-5833, ni nos visites en grupovaughan.com.
Curso intensivo para el First Exam, el programa de Vaughan para superar el examen oficial de Cambridge y obtener el First Certificate, B2. Para más información, grupovaughan.com.
Los cursos trimestrales de Vaughan son ideales para gente que necesita resultados a medio plazo y a un precio asequible. Descúbrelos en grupovaughan.com.
A Vaughan English class is not the same as other English classes. In a Vaughan English class, time is optimized to the max. Every minute counts for your company. Every minute counts for your English. It's all a question of mathematics. The more you practice key structures of the language in every class, the more confident you will be when you use them in real life. And the more effective you will be as a communicator in English. And in this global world of ours, communicating effectively is absolutely key to success. By means of face-to-face classes or video conference classes, Vaughan will make all the difference for your English. And you will make all the difference for your company.
Más información en Barcelona en el 933398687. En Madrid en el 911335831.
A ver, ¿qué pone aquí? Please select the first letter or your model number from the drop-down box, the begin search. Uf.
¿El inglés se te hace cuesta arriba? Este año te ayudamos a subir la cuesta del inglés con nuestros cursos trimestrales. Clases 100% método Vaughan para todos los niveles que te darán el empujón que necesitas para vencer todas tus dificultades con el idioma. Más información en el 91-133-5833 o en grupovaughan.com.
¿Do you Vaughan?
Llamamos a los gusanos en inglés. La respuesta correcta era la C.
Worms.
Que se escribe W-O-R-M-S, pero se pronuncia
Worms.
Ten en cuenta que
Worms
sirve tanto para gusanos como para lombrices, porque en inglés se llaman igual.
Worms.
Por cierto,
Lice
significa piojos y
Cockroaches,
cucarachas.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Vaughan Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking about nutmeg, nuez moscada. I was talking about spices in general and how they are not really appreciated. They all have their history. Every culinary tradition has its history, and I'll be talking about that perhaps on another program. But now I'd like to go back to one of the themes I've been talking about recently, about the Bourbon kings, the reforms that came in with Philip V of Spain. I mean, there was so much to be done. When El Hechizado, right, the bewitched, when Carlos II died, Charles II died, the last of the Habsburg kings. You can imagine, the treasury was empty. It was less than empty. It was nothing. The military practically did not exist. So many things had to be done. There was only one division in the military, the treasury, bankrupt, and commerce and industry don't even talk. You know, during France at this time, you had a mercantilism. You had this idea about Colbert, the French minister of finances. You had an idea that the country had to actively promote commerce, industry, that anything that was good for the economy was good for the country, that the economy was going to be the oxygen that the country needs to maintain an army, and the army and the economy going hand in hand, strengthening each other in a sort of a virtuous circle. Now, initially, there were many Frenchmen as advisors, but of course, as we know, Philip's second wife was Italian, and after that, everything else was Italian. And she, some of her sons were sent to Italy as kings, and she was always looking for an advantage for Italy. The advisors became Italian. And of course, after the death of the after the death of Philip VI, Carlos III came directly from Naples and brought with him all sorts of Italian advisors with the Italian Enlightenment and Italian ideas about how to make the most and how to institute these reforms. Unfortunately, there was a pacto de familia. There was an agreement among the Bourbons to help each other. And so Spain entered into the Seven Years' War with Great Britain. That was from 1756 to 1763. And the result was disastrous, completely disruptive, and it was a wake-up call, not just to Britain. It was a disaster for France, but it was a wake-up call for Charles III and for his advisors, especially the people concerned with America and the American colonies. Now, the reforms instituted, they began, well, first you had mining. There was first you had the economy itself. José de Campillo y Cossío's Nuevo Sistema de Gobierno Económico para la América. He made a detailed comparison of the systems of Britain, France, and Spain. Now, how was it possible that Britain and France do more with less? All of the advantages that Spain has, all of the extensive land, the level of control, all of these, the industry there, why isn't it more productive? How is it that the French and the British do more with less? Again, this is the beginning of this mercantilist idea. Jean-Baptiste Colbert, making government more efficient above all things. Following in the footsteps of all of the Bourbons and what the French were trying to do, making government more efficient. Now, José de Gálvez, I've mentioned him many times, one of my favorite characters, used him in my book, right? Spaniards, Un Paseo por la Historia de España, en inglés, this book about different characters, 40 different voices. Now, to talk about the Bourbon reforms, I use José de Gálvez, a fascinating person, began his life as a shepherd, pastor de ovejas, right? A shepherd in Malaga. And just through talent and recognition of his talent, something that probably would not have happened earlier, would not have happened under the Habsburgs. I mean, yes, the army recognizes talent and the church recognizes talent, but the government certainly doesn't. And the whole system of Hidalguía works against talent. There's only hierarchy there, right? Merit doesn't count for anything when you're talking about privilegios, private law. That's what privilegio means, private law. Now, José de Gálvez became the visitador general, a kind of an auditor, inspector, with dictatorial powers. And later, of course, he was going to be Minister of the Indies. He is the one who instituted the viceroyalty of Virreinato, the viceroyalty of New Granada. He is the one who started the viceroyalty of Rio de la Plata. The administrative reform was comprehensive. It involved control, corregidores, his own people, undermining, right, socavando, undermining the authority of the local people. In earlier times, it had been necessary to get a lot of money in a hurry. And in Spain, traditionally, when that happens, what they do is they sell positions or sell titles. So in many cases, you've got nobility who simply were able to purchase the titles they have. In many cases, you have people in the audiencia who were able to buy their way into it. You know, inspectors, other people who simply purchased their position, their jobs. And of course, their jobs allow them to recuperate this money. But of course, they have to do it in a very surreptitious way. But yes, corruption. But then it's understood. And so this is pan para hoy, hambre para mañana. This is a very short term, a very myopic thing to do, but they did it. And as a result, the native born, the criollos, were present pretty much everywhere. The criollos who would have been excluded from these positions, but were able to purchase these positions. Again, I am not talking about promotion based on merit, which you have that in the case of Galvez. You have that at least in theory as part of the Ilustración, as part of the Enlightenment, but you don't see it very often. Certainly not in the administration. So yeah, one of the one of the things he did was to reverse all of that in a area in which almost all of the members of the high court of the audiencia were criollos. Well, by the year 1807, only 12 out of the 99 judges were criollos. All of the others were Spanish-born. This, of course, is going to backfire after independence, because Spaniards are going to be considered like a fifth column. And by the year, 1830, I think there's a concerted effort to expel them from Mexico entirely. And, of course, everybody thinks this is a bad thing, but if we're talking about expulsions, Jews were expelled from Spain. The Moriscos were expelled from Spain. The Jesuits were expelled. Expulsion is not extraordinary. First. Secondly, the ones at least in Nueva España or in Mexico, the ones in Mexico are lucky because Spaniards were lynched in Venezuela. Spaniards were put into prison, tortured. All sorts of things happened in other areas. In Spain, it was simply an expulsion. Or rather, in Mexico, it was simply an expulsion. Now, before Galvez, Spanish America did not really have a strong military. There were militias, there were local things, there was, you know, organized military? No. And it was going to be absolutely necessary for defense purposes in a, this is the beginning of globalización. This is the beginning of the world coming closer together and becoming more dangerous. Because remember that the Seven Years' War was a world war. Winston Churchill called it the First World War. And so now, Spanish possessions in America were in danger from Britain, direct danger from Britain. It was going to be necessary to form a real army. And so, yes, this military reform, it meant that, there were militias on a local level and competent military people, again, from Spain, put in charge at the highest level. Criollos who wanted status, criollos with a military vocation, again, they found that area closed off. By the way, evidently there were militias, just like las cofradías, right? The cofradías were all separated according to the castas, according to racial categories that people were put into, whether mixed race, again, Spaniard, criollo, mixed race, of mestizo, and mulatto, and cuadrón y octorón, and all of these different categories. Many of them had, again, their religious associations, usually connected to professional associations. And in this case, militia as well. Part of the reform included eliminating the fuero eclesiástico. That's clerical immunity. So that members of the clergy could not be tried, could not be brought to trial in royal courts. Members of the clergy escaped local jurisdiction, local jurisprudence entirely. So yes, the fuero eclesiástico, that was going to be, first it was abolished, then it was reinstated, then it was abolished again, and that's going to be very, very difficult in the history of Mexico, talking about the fuero eclesiástico and how accountable members of the clergy are, how if they have to respond to charges against them in court. All of that, again, contentious in the past, contentious, it's going to be throughout the history. Now, there was also the fuero for the army as well. The armed forces had their own courts, their own jurisdiction, and they were not accountable, not responsible to royal courts, to anyone but themselves. And this as well is going to be a point of controversy in the future, especially in areas as susceptible to pronunciamientos or coup d'etats as is Mexico. In 1763, of course, I mentioned this on an earlier program, the 2,200 Jesuits living in these viceroyalties were expelled. Of those 2,200, 678 were from Mexico. 75% of the Jesuits in Mexico were born in Mexico. These were criollos. These were local people. You can imagine if it had been a question of expelling foreigners, of Spaniards, for example, that would not have been as offensive to the locals. But yes, this was one thing that was enormously unpopular. One wonders why Charles did it. Again, there are some theories. Somebody convinced Charles that the Jesuits were behind the Motin de Esquilache in Madrid, which of course cost him one of his most valued ministers, one that he had brought over from Naples. And the other theory is that in Paraguay, the Jesuits were teaching self-defense to the local indigenous peoples. In addition to evangelizing, in addition to teaching them modern economics, they were teaching them how to defend themselves against increasing encroachment, intromisión, encroachment by the colonists, by the Spaniards. They were all sent to the Italian port of Civitavecchia, but the Pope at that time, Clement the 13th, didn't want to anything to do with the Jesuits. He refused to let these people set foot on papal territory. So, without knowing what else to do, they all went to Corsica. Right, the island of Corsica. But there was a rebellion, and it took the longest time, for the Jesuits. Well, remember that Charles III had come from Naples, and anything he wanted was going to happen in Naples, so he refused them access to Naples as well. This was, again, surprising, sudden, devastating, and very shortly after, the Jesuit order is going to be abolished, removed, eliminated entirely. On an earlier program, I talked about the tobacco monopoly there, and how the tobacco monopoly, this increased bureaucracy, well, exponentially. It increased the red tape. It increased paperwork. There were inspectors and at every level of the production, harvest, distribution, shipping, all of this of the tobacco, and this was all done in an effort to reduce contraband, to stop smuggling. That's how we call it in English, smuggling. But evidently, certainly in the case of Cuba, smuggling actually increased rather than decreased. The creation of these large factories, like Tabacalera in Madrid or the one in Sevilla, well, there were five in Mexico, giving employment to 13,000 people. This might have been a way to deal with the urban poor. However, what essentially you're doing with these bourbon reforms is eliminating the class of artesanos, right? Of craftspeople, with an increased number of royal monopolies, monopolies on things like cloth and all of that. Things are only available on a large scale, and through these government-sponsored projects that are designed for increased revenue for higher levels of taxation. And essentially, you're eliminating the middle class because the artesanos, the tradespeople, the craftspeople, the people that would live better in a more open economy, a less government-controlled economy, all of these people have no future. I mean, in Mexican history, you're going to see this again and again with some of the reforms of Benito Juarez or the Porfiriato. People are going to buy, at least in Mexico City, they're going to buy in department stores rather than in neighborhood shops. The scale is going to be larger. It's going to be more rational, of course, more organized. But, again, this does nothing to foment the creation of a middle class. All right, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Para ejecutivos y profesionales de alto rendimiento a tiempo parcial durante 5 meses. Este